It does need to be clearly understood that this piece was produced before the Oscars for 2004 were awarded. In truth, it was the nominations, whereby this movie was totally snubbed by the Academy, that spurred me on to produce this appreciation, because I feel that this was one of the great films of the year. It is a special work from an eclectic group of filmmakers, taking a familiar character and genre and adding enough cinema magic to take a film from just being an enjoyable romp to being great. No wonder the working title for the film was Sacrifice. Truly was an apt title for a very worthy film that, just like its character, in Oscar terms, was sacrificed at the altar of summer blockbusterdom. Hi, welcome to this edition of Screen Gems. I'm Rennie Mann, and this is Spider-Man 2. Sure, it got some nominations for technical awards, and hopefully it won some, but I'm just so disappointed that it wasn't nominated for any of the major awards. But we'll get onto the Academy issues a bit later in this piece. First, let's talk about the movie. Too many people responded that they were very, very surprised that this sequel was better than the original. And it's true that sometimes sequels are better, but only sometimes. Rocky 2 is a perfect example of the most times where the sequel is much worse than the original. In fact, in Rocky 2's case, it's just an inferior remake of the original. But sometimes they are better. And it's sort of understandable. It's easier to get into a great story once the characters and the layout have already been established. As a wonderful example, French Connection 2 completely outshone the original classic by far. It is a rare occurrence, and it's tantalizing when it occurs. But that's not really the case in this instance. Don't get me wrong, this film is much better than the first installment. But this isn't a sequel. This is obviously Act 2 in a three-act drama. And I do believe we have to make that distinction between sequels and installments in multi-act dramas. It really does help to understand why each of the original series of Star Wars films got better and better. That is, episodes 4, 5, 6. Why each installment of The Lord of the Rings was more enjoyable than the previous one. In both of those cases, both were separate acts within a completely formulated multi-act drama. And what I mean by completely formulated, I mean that complete multi-act drama was painted before they began shooting the first scene of the first installment. Now that's very, very, very different to something like Raiders of the Lost Ark. Again, a wonderful series, three films, but there's no doubt that the first in the series, Raiders of the Lost Ark, was much better than any of the sequels. And that's because they were sequels, or in fact a prequel in case of the third installment. What I'm driving at here is that I really can't wait to see the third act. I can't wait to see the next in the series, especially if Sam Raimi is still primarily responsible. Raimi, who directed both of this current crop of Spider-Man incarnations, is a wonderful filmmaker. Unfortunately, his directing output has been sparse, but in these films, he's had the creative responsibility. They are his films. Spider-Man 2 has his stamp all over it. And fortunately for us, Raimi has just not been a not busy director, but he's also been a busy writer and producer simultaneously. He's had a lot of creative responsibility for a lot of films and TV shows. I first noticed him, like many others, with The Evil Dead, one of the most loved horror flicks of the 80s. I probably only saw it because of its video release in Australia at the time, which, you know, sort of coincided with the beginning of commercial video, and we were looking at everything that we could. But it was also the point where a lot of smaller films got their initial release on video. Here, there was a new platform to distribute these smaller, wonderful little films. Evil Dead was one of those. In fact, amongst many other tributes to other movies, such as King Kong, The Elephant Man, and I'll leave you to find those, there's a shot of a severed arm of a doctor in an operating room scene, and the arm is still clutching a chainsaw, And this shot is lifted straight out of Raimi's Evil Dead sequel, Evil Dead 2. And I have to say, you have to really enjoy a filmmaker who pays homage to himself. Raimi's always making dark and foreboding movies. His other films as director and writer of note include, obviously, the Evil Dead sequels and Darkman. And as a writer, he's also contributed to the Coen brothers' The Hudsucker Proxy. But it's as a producer where he's been most prolific. Including most of the films already mentioned, his production company produced hours and hours of television, including the Xena and Hercules franchises, as well as the Spy Game series and Jack of All Trades. His older brother is actor Ted Raimi, and he has a younger brother who's a frequent writing collaborator, Ivan Raimi. But it's Sam, who was always the big fan of comic book characters and especially Spider-Man. In fact, he tried to make a film of Thor with Stan Lee, Spider-Man's co-creator, which just never materialized. But this friendship with Stan Lee remained, and it was probably one of the key reasons why Raimi finally did end up being the creative responsible for this Spider-Man installments. It's been reported that Raimi is very into the physical nature of what's on screen, always acrobatic in character and action. He was a big fan of the Three Stooges, and he maintains that physicality of character and action on screen. And although Raimi is a great writer, he in fact wasn't the writer of this gem. The writing credits on this film were quite complicated, which is usually a recipe for disaster, but this time it seems to work. Stan Lee and Steve Ditko get an initial writing credit for actually creating the comic book, and that's only natural as they were the joint creators of the characters, whether it be Spider-Man, whether it be the girlfriend, whether it be the uncle and aunt, whether it be some of the other supporting characters. It's probable that some drafts were written by Alfred Goff and Miles Millar in collaboration. They have a joint credit for screen story, and their credit is represented by the ampersand rather than the AND, which signifies their collaboration. They've collaborated on many features in the past, including Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Nights, Lethal Weapon 4, and even, in fact, episodes of Smallville, the Superman TV series. Then there's Michael Chabon, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, who also wrote the novel of the Wonder Boys, which was turned into a movie by Curtis Hanson. He gets a spelled AND, that is A-N-D, in the writing credits, which usually means he wrote his own draft or drafts or added elements to drafts written by Goff and Miles Millar. As I'd said previously, these three writers were credited with screen story. The only writer, and he gets the sole screenplay credit, is Alvin Sargent. Now, I've got to be frank, judging how well the story is crafted, that's no big surprise. Sargent has been writing for film and TV from the early 50s. From classic TV fare such as Route 66 and Ben Casey, then cinema wonders including Sterile Cuckoo, Paper Moon, Julia, Ordinary People, Accidental Hero, and even The Recent Unfaithful, as just a few of the hits within his entire body of work. All of those mentioned are very strong character-driven works. Sargent's actually won two Academy Awards in the past, one for Julia and one for Ordinary People. In all frankness, it was a master stroke to bring him in to write the screenplay. And speaking of character-driven filmmakers, this film was co-produced by Laura Ziskind. Now, just touching back on where she came from, one of her first jobs was as an assistant to John Peters while making the Barbra Streisand Star is Born remake in 1976. But she quickly rose through the producing ranks, becoming the associate producer of The Eyes of Laura Mars, and then becoming the producer of such hits as Murphy's Romance, No Way Out, which was one of Kevin Costner's breakout films, Hero or Accidental Hero, and even executive producer on Pretty Woman and As Good As It Gets. She's worked in TV as well as film, mainly on special projects, including becoming the executive producer of the remake of Failsafe, which I'd like to talk about at another time. But just to reinforce, they are all very strong character-driven projects. No big action vehicle to be found amongst them. And her co-producer on Spider-Man 2 is Avi Arad, who in fact is head of Marvel Studios, which makes him primarily responsible for all of the Marvel media projects. Now, it's difficult to say where Arad as producer stops and Arad as executive producer starts. But suffice it to say that most of the Marvel films under Arad have been very successful, sort of critically as well as at the box office. Blade franchise, the X-Men franchise, obviously the Spider-Man franchises, amongst many others. Now, you can't lay all of that action to the franchise's appeals. There's been some hefty producing of these films. They've all been well cast, well crewed, well positioned in the marketplace. And, in all honesty, Arad is the most common denominator. Now, there are obviously too many people in the credits to mention. There are a few that I could waffle on for hours over, including Danny Elfman, who did the original score. But the last one that I want to really highlight was John Dykstra, who's responsible for the special effects supervision. Dykstra got his start with a great little movie called Silent Running. It was a film made by Douglas Trumbull, and in fact co-written by Michael Cimino and Steve Bochco, amongst others. Now, Trumbull goes back to some of the pioneering special effects on 2001. He brought Dykstra in on a few films, including the initial Star Trek movie, but Dykstra is mostly known as the special photographic effects supervisor on the original Star Wars film, the original Chapter 4. The success of Star Wars gave him the opportunity to produce the original Battlestar Galactica series on TV, but he obviously still kept his hand in cinema with films such as Firefox, Invaders from Mars, some of the Batman films, and so on. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to focus on Dykstra and his work is that he's one of the special effects guys who cut their teeth on special effects when they meant photographic effects. Silent Running, Star Wars, Chapter 4, the effects were all photographic, made with film. Dykstra has been very able to move from photographic effects, from chemical photographic effects, to digital effect. But not only has he been able to make the transition, but even judging by his work in the Spider-Man films, he's made that transition incredibly well. And please note, I would maintain that unlike most of the superhero genre of movies, in this movie, the action is not the star, the characters are. The action, the effects, they play supporting roles, but play them seamlessly, as adding all the nuance necessary to character. You just believe, which at last brings me to the character and the story. First up, I want to say what the film is not about. The central drama is not about Spider-Man's battles with the bad guys. Sure, there's a mad scientist, Dr. Octavius, and although fiendishly played by Alfred Molina, he's not the villain of the piece. Neither is Spidey's complicated nemesis, Harry Osborn. No, the villain of this piece is the sacrificial lifestyle demanded of heroism. The line of dramatic action is Peter Parker's internal conflict with himself in deciding whether to choose to continue to be a hero. I mean, how much of his personal life should he have to sacrifice to be a hero? Then there's the associated questions that the film tries to answer, such as what's the overall importance of heroism to and within one's community? It is only upon answering these questions that Peter Parker, or in fact Spider-Man, has any hope to survive on the one hand and stop the villains on the other hand. It's a story that would be every psychologist's wet dream, and especially having Spider-Man on the couch. But Parker is truly alone trying to answer these questions. Sure, he's ably supported by his maternal aunt, hitting him right between the eyes with her hero speech.
Everybody loves a hero. People line up for them, cheer them, scream their names, and years later they'll tell how they stood in the rain for hours just to get a glimpse of the one who taught him to hold on a second longer. I believe there's a hero in all of us that keeps us honest, gives us strength, makes us noble. and finally allows us to die with pride. Even though sometimes we have to be steady and give up the thing we want the most. Even our dreams. Spider-Man did that for Henry, and he wonders where he's gone. He needs him.
Supported by his late deceased uncle in a quasi-flashback-slash-vision scene where Cliff Robertson again reprises his performance and delivers that most disturbing of homilies.
I want a life of my own.
You've been given a gift, Peter. With great power comes great responsibility.
But it is Parker who demonstrates the depths of his feelings for family, with the realization that he blames himself for his uncle's death, for his inaction in the first film. It is this key issue that becomes the catalyst for his psychological stew. And then we have to obviously add the dramatic element of the relationship between power and belief. The growth of his psychological doubts are directly proportional to the loss of his physical powers. And it is true that once he conquers those doubts, his powers return without fail. But he does go through the whole sequence of the power of belief. I mean, there was a wonderful quasi-Peter Pan feeling about it all. Just believe and you can fly. Much of his sense of sacrifice stems from his inability to follow through on his love for Mary Jane Watson, even after she professes her love for him. There's a wonder to their relationship that surely has much to do with the performances of Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst. Whenever they're together, the screen lights up with fireworks, which is such a marvelous achievement, as they're truly not the prettiest people in the world. They've been perfectly cast, and they are wonderfully written and performed roles. Now, the casting and performances throughout are uniformly first rate. Jeez, only Rosemary Harris as Peter's aunt could deliver her hokey speech on heroism and make it work. James Franco as Parker's best friend and Spider-Man's ultimate nemesis, Harry Osborn, truly makes the absurdity of Osborn's dialectic believable. J.K. Simmons is given much more to work with in his reprisal of Daily Bugle newspaper publisher-editor J. Jonah Jameson.
It's all over town, Robbie. Gossip, rumors. Panic in the streets, we're lucky. Crazy scientist turns himself into some kind of a monster. Four mechanical arms welded right onto his body. Guy named Otto Octavius winds up with eight limbs. What are the odds? Hoffman!
Yeah?
What are we gonna call this guy?
Dr. Octopus.
That's crap.
Science Squid?
Crap.
Dr. Strange.
That's pretty good. But it's taken. Wait, I got it. Dr. Octopus.
I like it.
Of course you do. Dr. Octopus. New villain in town, Doc Ock.
Genius.
What, are you looking for a raise? Get out.
Every line he delivers is a roar. Every expression on his face fills us with delight. And of course, Alfred Molina as Otto Octavius provides us with a humane villain.
I will not die a monster.
That just captures the feeling and emotion of John Hurt's Elephant Man in a purely comic book form. Overall, what the filmmakers have done is deliver a warm, human drama. The hero must determine the value of heroism. Its warmth shines through its use of humor, not uproarious stand-up, but that humor that provides that warm feeling throughout the story. Like when we see the result of Peter Parker washing and drying his colorful costume with a load of whites. The visual humor when Spider-Man, standing atop a skyscraper at the beginning of his self-doubts, which manifest themselves with his momentary inability to spin a web, has to take the building elevator down to the ground, and shares the elevator with a good citizen.
Cool Spidey outfit.
Thanks.
Where'd you get it?
I made it.
Looks uncomfortable.
It gets kind of itchy. It rides up in the crotch a little bit, too.
the look on his face when he discovers that his aunt has given away his comic book collection. Even in the midst of one of the key action sequences, where Dr. Octavius has disabled a packed commuter train and sent it careering down the track to a potentially fiery doom, he turns to Spider-Man and just casually says,
"You have a train to catch."
Let's not forget that the whole exercise relates to comic book characters and form. The movie never lets us forget that and take itself too seriously. From the opening credits, where the original story is recaptured in comic book panels painted by Alec Ross, no stranger to Spider-Man, where within Octavius's bank robbery, the loot is made up of sacks of change, not a banknote to be found, where the movie's deus ex machina is just Spider-Man successfully convincing the mad scientist to be good again and commit suicide. Wonderful comic book fun. Not to be taken seriously, but still to be enjoyed. And let me just close by quickly talking about the Academy and its awards. It's no secret that Academy members give their nominations just after New Year for the awards of the year preceding them. We also know that winning a major award can have much impact on the box office of a new release, or even elevate the box office of a movie still in release. Therefore, many producers and production companies try and have the movies that they think could be in consideration for an Oscar somehow still being at the box office around the time of the nominations and awards. Therefore, they try and somehow release their films just before New Year to still be able to be nominated, and therefore still be able to be at the box office the following year. Anyway, all of that makes it very difficult for films that are released early in the year, even right up to summer, to be compared, remembered, aside all the end-of-year releases, which should really be the following year's batch anyway. Spider-Man 2 always had to be a summer blockbuster, and never really had a chance in this messed-up system. It's also one of those films whose domestic box office and even video revenues aren't going to be very affected by an Oscar win. It's already captured the lion's share of its domestic box office and video revenue before the awards are even nominated. It's a pity it never had a chance. Well, no matter who won, in my mind, Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst gave some of the performances of the year, and as did J.K. Simmons. And this, Spider-Man 2, happens to be one of the films of the year. I just wished it could have been considered, but that's life. So, till next time we meet, this is Rennie Mann. Enjoy those screen gems.
A Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. A spins a web. Catches these, or draws, or ties, or cuts.